Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Today, you're going to hear the story of a real-life Indiana Jones, a secret library, and the world's oldest printed book that was found inside it. My guests are two people who've literally been on the trail of this story, Joyce Morgan and Conrad Walters. They're both journalists with the Sydney Morning Herald. They're a married couple. And in their home in Sydney, on the mantelpiece, they keep a little vial of sand. And this sand is from the Taklamakan Desert in outer western China, and that's where today's story comes from. This desert was one of the most dangerous parts of the Silk Road, a road that was trod by Alexander the Great and served as a trading route between the Roman Empire and China. This is a part of the world with insanely exotic place names. The City of Kashgar, the Thieves' Road, the Salt Lake of Lop Nor, and the Caves of a Thousand Buddhas. And it was in these caves a century ago that a Chinese monk found the entrance to a secret library that had been sealed up for more than 1,000 years. And in that library, he found the Diamond Sutra, an ancient book that has inspired Jack Kerouac and the Dalai Lama. Journeys on the Silk Road is the name of their book. Joyce and Conrad, welcome to you both. Hello.
Hi, Richard. Thank you.
Now, Joyce, you two are travelling companions, you're a married couple. I just want you to explain to me, Joyce, the moment when you realised Conrad might be okay as a travelling companion.
That was about 20 years ago when we first got married, and at that time I'd done a lot of travelling in Asia and rough travelling across Central Asia, but Conrad hadn't, and I thought, if we're going to be married and it's going to work, he's going to have to be able to cope with this. So for our honeymoon, we went off to an island called Flores in Indonesia.
Oh, where the Hobbit's from. You know,
That's right, where the Hobbit's from.
Homo floresiensis, that strange dwarf-like humanoid creature.
Yes. That's right, exactly. So we went off to Hobbit land, and we were on a very overcrowded bus one day, going somewhere, and Conrad was seated beside me, and then this Indonesian lady came along and perched right beside him, and she was carrying a bag of live chickens, and she plonked them right on his knee, and he just didn't flinch.
Not a cage of live chickens,
Who doesn't like chicken? You know, a bit of garlic, a few leaves of tarragon, splash of white wine.
So you passed the livestock test, in other words, Conrad, did you?
He did.
And were you comfortable with a bag of chickens on your lap? They peck.
Yeah, you know? They were all right. I was a bit disappointed she wanted them back.
I knew he was the man for me then.
this story that you've put together, and you've been on the trail of it, is really around a library and a special book within this library that I mentioned in the introduction, the oldest printed book, the Diamond Sutra. First of all, Conrad, what is a sutra anyway, for those who don't follow the Buddhist faith?
A sutra is a teaching. It's sort of a sermon given by the Buddha. And so the Diamond Sutra is a teaching given by the Buddha in a conversation with a venerable old monk named Subhuti. And it eventuates as an exchange about the impermanence of everything around us and how we think things are solid and fixed, but they're not really. And if we sort of get our heads around that, the ultimate sense is that we lose our obsession with our ego and ourself. And we become more generous to the people around us and ultimately sort of become happier.
Okay. Sorry, you were going to say something there,
I was thinking, you know, one of the important things about the Diamond Sutra and one of the reasons it became so popular, particularly in the Zen tradition as well, is that you can actually recite it very quickly. You can recite it in about 45 minutes, whereas there's many, many sutras, and some of them take days and days and days to recite. So because you can recite this quickly, you can kind of get the, you know, in the the benefit and the blessings of this sutra. You know, very, very, you can...
So if you're time poor, it's a great sutra.
It's a great sutra.
Okay, if you're time poor, right, for busy people, busy and harassed people. What does the diamond bit refer to? Do we know what that is?
Yeah, the diamond, that's kind of a translation of a Sanskrit word. And we don't really have the right kind of word for that. But diamond, it kind of... implies it's harder than any other known material, so it cuts through ego and things like that. But Jack Kerouac didn't like that title. He had other, it has to be said, rather plodding titles.
What's wrong with the title? That's a great title, The Diamond Sutra, you know?
I think
it's
beautiful.
Something that's hard and cuts like nothing else.
Yeah. I think some of the concern is that as a literal translation, it's not quite accurate. If you're a Sanskrit expert.
I think it's stuck now. It's going to stay. It's
a nice... Kerouac want the slightly tough and somewhat cutting sutra. When were you made aware of the existence of The Diamond Sutra, Joyce?
I was made aware of it kind of like... by accident, almost. I was in, of all places, Los Angeles, and I was looking around the Getty Museum, and I had a look around their conservation department. Somebody, a gentleman, showing me around, what they were doing. And there was an image on a computer screen of the caves, and it was just very fleeting. As we walked past, he said, "Oh, yes, that's some work we're doing in the Gobi Desert, restoring these, conserving these murals in these caves." And
this is the caves of the Thousand Buddhas.
This is the caves of the Thousand Buddhas at a little oasis called Dun Huang. And somehow it just pressed all my buttons. I thought, Buddhist caves, Gobi Desert, I've got to go and see these. And so we went out there a few years ago, and I went to do a story about conservation. But as we were there, we started hearing more and more about this hidden cave. People were talking about that. And I guess we thought, we didn't know about this hidden cave. We hadn't heard about it. And the more we heard, we thought there was like a ripping yarn behind this. And
about what was in there.
About what was in there, how it was found, how it got back to London. And
indeed, a ripping yarn it is. Let's talk a bit about the Silk Road itself there, because this is where it all begins. The Silk Road, I think most people are aware that was the route by which silk came from China to the Roman Empire. I did a bit of research on this, and Diocletian, the Roman emperor who set prices on... He was the first emperor to try and fix prices, maximum prices for things. The highest value of any good he set was for purple-coloured silk. He set a price at 150,000 denarii, which was the same price of a lion.
Wow, like, I didn't know that.
150,000 denarii would get you a pound of purple silk or a lion in the Roman Empire.
And a lovely pink purple silk toga.
Indeed, very nice. So the origin of silk was mysterious to the Romans, wasn't it?
Yeah, because what happened was, the people who went along the Silk Road, the merchants who travelled, they didn't travel from one end to the other. It was like convoys, so, they'd stop halfway.
It's too far.
So another lot of camels and camel men would take over. So it suited the people in the middle for one end not to know too much about the other end. So there was lots of myths, particularly among the Romans, who thought, first of all, that silk grew on trees and you plucked it. And you can kind of see there's an element of truth almost in that. But they also thought the people who lived in what they call the land of silk, Ceres, there was rumours that they lived for 200 years.
They were giants.
They were
with faces on their stomachs, that kind of thing.
It's a bit kind of Gulliver's Travels almost, some of the myths that grew up about it. So the Romans, they loved silk, and it pretty near bankrupted them. The Senate didn't want them to, they tried to ban silk, because it was so expensive and slightly,
showy and decadent and all those things.
Showy and decadent and all of that.
You say that knowingly, this sense of decadence, I think.
So with all this money coming through that part of the world, it was the site of great empires, and there was a wonderful kind of Buddhist empire that was kind of there for a while, and it brought in Roman influence and Chinese influence. It was a bit of a mishmash, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great contributions of this explorer, Orel Stein, is that he sort of had this hunch that underneath the sands, particularly of this desert, Taklamakan Desert, there were lost Buddhist civilizations. And although that region is Muslim now and increasingly Chinese, he knew that underneath it, before that, it had been Buddhist. But he also knew that because of the Silk Road, there's been lots of exchanges between East and West. So some of the things he found along the Silk Road when he was digging were like images of Greek and Roman gods, you know, of Athena.
Now, this is somewhere between China and Afghanistan, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Well, of course, Alexander the Great had gone through Afghanistan, and you see the influence of that kind of ancient Greek civilization in the images of the Buddha from that region. Because if you look even at the Bamiyan Buddhas, they're very sort of Roman-looking in the way they're...
Well, they've got togas, have they?
Pretty much, yeah. They've got togas, they're standing up. And if you see images from there, you get lots of mustachioed Buddhas and curly, you know, like wavy hair kind of Buddhas.
Which isn't the bald-headed sort of figure we think
about. Yeah, the chubby
about.
Laughing dude, the big fat laughing dude that we've seen on the, you know, in Chinatown.
That's right. Yeah, they're quite macho, these Buddhas that you see from that region, yeah.
So you went out there to have a look. You went across this desert, Joyce.
Yeah.
You approached it as any decent pilgrim would going through the desert. Tell me about that trek you met. And did you do it by camel?
I did. Yes, I went out on a camel from Dun Huang because I wanted to get a feel of what it was like to be in these rolling dunes. Because near Dun Huang, the dune, it's like the desert from Central Casting. You know, it's massive, like an ocean of sand. And I just wanted to get a feel for what it would be like to sleep out in those dunes. So I hired a camel man and I went out just camped out for a night, and this camel man took me, you know, first of all, we had to go through a graveyard, which was kind of right on probably the loneliest graveyard I've ever seen on the edge of the dunes.
What does a graveyard look like in that part of the world?
It looks like brick pyramids, and they're incredibly elaborate, but they're all built on sand.
So the bricks sort of circle the grave and hold the sand in place and hold the body in place, I suppose. But the backdrop is just these dunes that sort of soar up, you know, a few hundred meters. And the wind was blowing across when I went back with her the next day. And it's just so ethereal to see this sort of out in the middle of nowhere.
Now, didn't Marco Polo said what a spooky place this was, didn't he?
There are so many rumours about goblins and that lead you astray. And, you know, although there's had a myth-like, even people who went... Europeans who went in the 30s, there was a couple of very doughty British female missionaries who went out, and they talked about hearing these voices and, you know, as though they were being called to. And I think, so there is perhaps a basis in truth in some of these, because also just near those sands that I went out into, their local name is the Rumbling Sands, and in certain winds and certain ways you can approach them, they do, apparently they sing, they rumble.
Did you hear that?
Well, the sad thing is now, because of the pollution in the last couple of decades, the sad thing is they've stopped rumbling, which is...
The rumbling sands of Lop Nor, I love it.
Yes, that's right, yes.
So you were taken out by this guide through the deserts with camels and everything like that. Tell me how your guide managed to find you a chair at the end of the day.
Well, yes, at the end of the day, you know, and we're pretty sore after sitting on a camel all day. And
I made sure I didn't go. I left that to Joyce.
You left Joyce for that bit?
Yeah, I was sampling the beer.
Yeah, you had a bag of chickens to hold.
Yeah.
That's right. A bag of chickens left in Dun Huang to mind them. So I went out, and at the end of the day, you know, we hopped off in the middle of a sand dune, and suddenly this camel man, who I thought at first perhaps he was exhausted, even though he'd been singing the entire way along, but he fell on his knees and he started digging in the sand. And
where was it? Was there any marker of any kind?
There was the only marker I could determine was like a little bush about 3 foot high that was several meters away. Now, that perhaps was his marker. I don't know. That was the only thing that I could tell.
So he's digging in an apparently random spot in the desert.
And I'm going, what's he doing? What's he doing? And then after a couple of minutes, he pulls from the sand this black plastic bin liner, you know, like buried treasure. And I thought, what on earth he got in there? And then it was like abracadabra. He pulls out a little camp chair to sit on, which... At the end of sitting on a camel for several hours, like, you're extremely glad for something else to sit on and something that had a little bit of a backrest.
Do you love the desert? Is it this poetic, wonderful experience, or is it just a nightmare with sand in every part of your body you need to get out?
The desert landscapes are probably my favourite landscape.
Why?
I love the silence that you can get in the desert. You know, you realise in the 20th century, you virtually never hear silence. I love that. I love the fact that, you know, life's a real struggle for all creatures in there. On the one hand, it's a struggle. But on the other hand, a desert preserves, you know, evidence of human existence and other existence like no other landscape because it is so dry. And that's part of it. And I also find that they're infinitely different. No two deserts are alike in my book.
My guests in conversation today are Joyce Morgan and Conrad Walters, and they've written a book together called Journeys on the Silk Road. And it's the story of how they went on the trail of, and I'll come to him in a moment, a kind of Jewish Hungarian Indiana Jones and the uncovering of the Diamond Sutra 100 years ago, a book, the oldest printed book in the world that was hidden for over 1,000 years in a secret library. Now, this was found in a place, the book was found in a place called the Caves of 1,000 Buddhas, you mentioned a bit earlier there. Just tell me about this place. What is the Cave of 1,000 Buddhas? I'll ask you that, Conrad.
It's a collection of meditation caves that were created creating reverence to the Buddha, and they became monastic centers. About 500 of them survive now. And in 1900, a Taoist monk went to this site that had been abandoned for centuries and was just so captivated with the beauty of these caves that he decided to appoint himself as guardian of them.
Now, what does it look like? Is it in the middle of the desert or on the edge of the deserts?
It's on the edge of the desert. It's near a place called Dunhuang in what is present-day Gansu province. It's still pretty far out west. And
It's a river valley, and it's really sandwiched between two deserts, the Gobi Desert on the one hand and the Taklamakan, the smaller but more fearsome desert, on the other. And the caves stretch about a kilometre along a cliff, and the explorer Oral Stein described them as looking like troglodyte dwellings from a distance. Yeah, and they do.
All carved.
And they're all absolutely beautiful inside, aren't they?
One's painted differently, and you know, so there's these images of the Buddha. There's morality tales painted on there, and yet there's also some sort of secular material. There's a piece we love where there's a butcher, and there's this dog sneaking up and stealing some of the meat off the butcher's table. And so there's these images of life on the Silk Road.
So it's kind of religious and bawdy at the same time. There's like an image of a guy defecating as well, isn't there? You know, they're like human scenes as well as divine ones.
Some of them remind me of manga comics today because they tell stories. Mm. And of course, when they were painted, you didn't have a literate population. So it was almost like painting cartoons on a wall. So
why were they there? Why were these caves put at this spot? What was the significance for have this kind of amazing monastic kind of centre with these thousands of Buddhist caves?
Yeah, the significance was that at this part of the Silk Road, to go west from there, you're approaching like the most dangerous part of the Silk Road because you were facing this incredible desert. You had to kind of hop from oasis to oasis. There was lots of bandits along there, so there was physical dangers from being robbed, but there was also dust storms that were known to bury entire caravans. So the dust storms blow up usually around the northern springtime, around April.
So you can imagine the ferocity. The sky just becomes black with the sand sort of blasting down on you.
Yeah.
So people just it's a very even bet whether you survive that desert. So
really.
So they'd stop there before and after.
So they'd stop there, before they headed into this really dangerous area to pray for a good journey. And if they survived it, they'd come on the way back to give thanks. And, they might offer some money if they were a wealthy merchant to pay for a cave to be carved out or painted.
I get this sense of the desert that kind of rolls up to its door and this kind of arid, spare wasteland. But within there's this rich, beautiful kind of in a world inside these caves.
That's true. And for a long time, the caves were abandoned, and the sand sort of filled those caves. And when this Taoist monk arrived, he set upon, you know, clearing them and restoring them.
So let's talk about him now then, the Taoist monk, Abbot Wang. I love that name. That's great. So he came. You said he came to be in the place because he found these caves. Well, they'd been virtually abandoned, and he made themselves his guardian. So what did he begin to do once he became the guardian of this place?
He went around on begging tours collecting money so that he could hire laborers to clear out these sort of centuries of sand that had filled up these caves over the years, and to commission paintings to restore the artwork that was there and to build new statues, all in honor of the Buddha.
And this is all the turn of the last century. This is around 1900 or thereabouts. This is taking place.
Yeah.
So within this network of caves, he then discovers something a bit special. How did he discover it, Joyce?
Well, what seemed to have happened was that one day he was in that cave clearing out, you know, hundreds of years of sand with his workmen, and they drew his attention to a crack in the wall. And there must have been, you know, there's lots of cracks, of course, in these old caves, but there must have been something significant about this particular crack, because perhaps he tapped on it and realized it was hollow.
And it's painted. It's got a mural over it, so it's not obvious that there should be anything back there.
That's right. It's quite concealed. You know, it's been very, very carefully concealed. Anyway, for whatever reason, he broke through this cave, broke through this crack, and behind he discovered this little hidden chamber, which is about 3 meters by 3 meters wide.
Oh, it's not big.
It's tiny. It's like about the size of a bathroom, you know, a suburban bathroom. It's really a tiny cave.
And it sounds like they had all the time in the world to seal it up, too, by the sound of things, if it was carefully concealed. Now, there were two guardians there, too, weren't there? Guardians in the front of the
There was library. A painting of these two figures against the back wall, but it was so filled with material. There was about 50,000 to 60,000 scrolls piled up in this thing that you could barely see them in the back.
No one's really sure exactly how many scrolls were in there, but it seems like there was at least 50,000 or 60,000.
How long had they been trapped in there, these scrolls and these painted figures?
They'd been trapped in there for 1,000 years.
So they were put there sometime around the 800 and something AD or thereabouts.
Yeah, a little bit later than that. Yeah, about
868 AD, thereabouts. So, and they've been walled up in there all this time. When I say trapped, I mean kept safe, really, I suppose.
There's no more perfect way to conserve things than in the dry desert air. You know, that's how they were able to survive until today, because there was nothing to destroy them. There was no humidity. It didn't rain. It was dark. You know, it's absolutely perfect.
So what was in there? What were in these scrolls?
Aside from the world's oldest printed book, there was a lot of secular material that was quite incredible. There's a eulogy for a donkey.
Really?
Yeah. There's a...
donkey thou, good and faithful servant, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a recipe for a hair tonic, which probably tell people why they can't see us today, because there's also instructions for conferring invisibility. So if people are worried about, you know, look, it's radio and I can't see Richard or Joyce or Conrad, that's why.
That's because we're invisible, yes. So all these kind of things are in there. So there's religious documents and just day-to-day stuff as well.
Yeah.
Kept up in this place.
Aside from the oldest book, there's a few other things that are sort of oldest. There's the oldest Chinese music to survive. There's the oldest depiction of firearms, because there's this painting of the Buddha meditating, and there are these demons trying to disrupt his meditation, and one is shooting at him with a fire lance, which is a sort of early flamethrower. And there's another
demons
one.
Demons with guns.
Yeah. And another demon has a grenade. And so there's these extraordinary, you know, things of history in there.
But then why? Why was it sealed up? Given that, there's this beautiful text here, the Diamond Sutra, and there's other kind of more mundane sort of scrolls. Why was it sealed up for 1,000 years?
Look, it's a fabulous mystery why it was sealed up, because, you know, people have said, well, perhaps it was because, you know, the Muslims were coming. And that's true. They were making their way over from the West. But because it was sealed so slowly, you know, it's obviously not been done when the invaders are at the gates because, you know, they've had time to, you know, paint it and seal it. And it's been very carefully done.
So it's been carefully done. Could it be a time capsule?
Oh, it's very much a time capsule.
But I mean, could it have been sealed in with the intent of making it a time capsule?
Well, it's possible in as much as it could have been sealed because it could have just been a storeroom for material not needed anymore. For the monasteries didn't need these particular scrolls anymore. They were well worn. Paper was very special then, you know, you couldn't just go and buy it in the shop, so it was valuable. And you can't just kind of toss away old Buddhist scriptures. Even today, you have to take care of scriptures, you know.
But that doesn't explain why it was sealed, like it was something precious. It's a mystery, isn't it?
It is a mystery, it really is. But, you know, we're open to theories.
Now, you say the world's oldest book, and it was made 500 years before the Gutenberg Bible.
Yeah.
How was it printed?
It was used wood blocks, and these were printed on 7 sheets of the paper, which were then sort of assembled and then rolled into a scroll, which is an early form of the book.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Joyce Morgan and Conrad Walters are my guests today. For years, they've been just about living and breathing and on the trail of the story of the world's oldest book, printed book, the Diamond Sutra, which was discovered 100 years ago in a sealed-up secret library deep within the caves of 1,000 Buddhas. How cool does that sound? That sounds kind of amazing, doesn't it, when you put it like that? Now, before we were just talking about the discovery of this secret library by this Taoist monk, Abbot Wang, as he's called. Once he found this secret room and the scrolls within, did he try and keep it a secret, Joyce?
He didn't. They were still sealed up. What he tried to do was to interest people in what he'd found. And so he took some scrolls to local officials because although he was kind of illiterate, he sensed he had something valuable there, but he couldn't get anybody to take any interest and there was no money to take the scrolls away by donkey to the nearest major town. So the officials just said, oh, look, seal it up. You just got to seal it up again. So, you know, I think he was quite sad that he had to do that. So he followed orders and left it sealed.
Well, he mostly followed orders because he was so desperate to restore these beautiful caves that he would go around on begging tours, I think we said before, but he would also occasionally dole out a few of these scrolls.
That's right, to curry a bit of favour and earn a little bit of money.
He's a bit of a hero then, isn't he, this monk? What a wonderful guy to devote his life in such a way to do that.
Well, he certainly wasn't, you know, a greedy man.
No.
He never spent, you know, Oral Stein, I think, recognised that when he came along, that in a sense they were rather similar characters because neither of them were really interested in their own comfort or spending money on themselves. They were actually interested in their respective work.
Okay, well, let's get to him now. Oral Stein, the Indiana Jones of the 1900s, as it is. Paint me a picture of Oral Stein, please, Joyce.
Slightly eccentric. He was born in Budapest and he grew up studying languages. He was fascinated as a kid by Alexander the Great, so he always kind of loved the past. As he grew up, he he studied Sanskrit and Oriental languages and things, although not Chinese. But he went over to Britain, perhaps to further his studies, and I think he probably had his eye on an academic career, but that didn't sort of work out. So he took a job, it was the height of the Raj era, so he took a fairly lowly job in the education section of the Raj, and when he was about 26, he set sail for India. And in one sense, he never left because he kept kind of he based himself for the rest of his life whenever he could. He lived on a hillside in the north of Kashmir, in the north of India, in his little canvas tent. And he never really had a permanent home. He was sort of, very gypsy-like. He was a funny mix of scholar and explorer. He was never going to be happy just like reading books in a university. He just had to get out there and travel.
He was a man of action.
Tough as old boots.
Tough as old boots, a man of intellect and action.
He was also, you know, a guy of incredible endurance. He's only about 5 foot tall, so he's approximately one Joyce high.
Yes, that's right. And he had a moustache that was almost as long as he was tall. What did he mean?
Officer class moustache.
At one point when he was in his elderly years, he went out on a sort of walk with a soldier who had been assigned to him from the Indian Army. And afterward, the soldier went to his commanding officer and begged him, please don't ever make me go off with that guy again.
Why?
He walked me off my feet.
Oh, right. So he's a tough guy. He was really interested in the origins. You're right, he was interested in the origins of Buddhism, which, unlike Christianity and Islam and Judaism, it really wasn't well known to Europeans in those days. Where did they think the Buddha might be from in those days?
Well, even until the early 19th century, people thought the Buddha had come from Africa.
Why?
It was because of the curly hair. They thought perhaps he and the shape
nose,
of the nose,
right,
the flat nose. They thought he was perhaps had African origins, or he was a mythological figure.
Which seems extraordinary now.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. To think that the Buddha, that they might argue the Buddha would come from Africa, that was just their best guess.
Yeah. So in many, and what had happened was, you know, Buddhism had pretty much died out from its birthplace in India, and it. It was sort of forgotten about its origins. They'd just been lost in you know, the mists of time. So it really took until some of these rather extraordinary English Raj-era administrators who went off kind of in search of various archaeological sites. They were digging them up, and it was very much Indiana Jones kind of stuff. And they started uncovering things in what we now think of as the Buddhist Holy Land of northern India. But although they, you know, were making these discoveries in the 18th, 19th century, that Buddhism had been forgotten, of course, in that time. But the people who remembered it were the Chinese. And the reason they did was that a very ancient Chinese pilgrim in the 6th century had gone from China. He'd walked all the way through what we now think of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and he'd gone to the north of India to collect scrolls.
This is a 16-year journey this guy went on.
Yeah, all on foot, or occasionally elephant. And he got these scrolls, and he went all the way back to India and Pakistan and back to China, and he wrote accounts of his travels. And he translated these scrolls.
And did Oral Stein have that account?
Yeah, he did. It had recently been translated into English. And so he had this account of this pilgrim's travel. And he travelled with it almost like today you travel with a Lonely Planet guide. Because this guy, this ancient pilgrim, gave extremely accurate details.
Oh, it's stop at this oasis for water, stop here to get camels, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He just about documented every single kind of Buddhist stupor he'd seen. I mean, some of it is just kind of like mind-glazingly, you know.
But for a pinhead like Stein, this guy was his, you know, patron saint.
But what one of the interesting things this little monk wrote about was he gave the very first written account of the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan, and he described how they were at that stage all covered in gold. He described the two figures, and curiously he described a third Bamiyan Buddha that was lying down and much bigger than the two that the Taliban
destroyed. We're talking here of the gigantic, huge statues of the Buddha that were there in that part of Afghanistan up until, 10 years ago
or
so. They're like 200-foot-high statues of the Buddha, weren't
they? Oh, they were absolutely enormous. Yeah.
Beautiful images you've seen of them, but they were destroyed by the Taliban. The Taliban's orders as being an affront to them.
Yeah.
So there's descriptions of them covered in gold.
Covered in gold and glinting in the sun. They're beautiful descriptions. I wasn't aware of them until I started researching this, and I was absolutely captivated. And I was intrigued by this, you know, possibility of a third Bamiyan Buddha. Nobody's found it yet, although there is an archaeologist, I gather, still looking for it.
Well, I think they would have found it by now. They're kind of conspicuous 200-foot statues.
Yes, you couldn't exactly hide them. Cover them with a bit of grass
right.
or something.
You can't put them under the bed, can you? No, you can't. So Orlstein goes off on this pilgrim's route and goes and hears rumours of the caves of 1,000 Buddhas. And here's the rumours of a secret library. But he's in a race, isn't he? Because there's some Germans who want to get there too. I love this is the other Indiana Jones side of thing. He's in a race against Germans to get to this archaeological treasure.
That's right. He knows that the Germans and the French, in fact, are on his trail. And he keeps, you know, there's... So when you read his letters, as we did, you get this sense he's like terrified he's going to find them around every sand dune. You know, he's really worried that they're going to follow him, or even worse, get there before him. And the reason they were out there doing these expeditions in that's part of the world was because they knew he'd already been on an expedition a few years earlier, and he'd brought back lots of incredible material to the British Museum. So that success of his first expedition had prompted all these rivals to, you know, pack their buckets and spades and head off to Turkestan.
And in fact, the Germans really should have got there first.
Why didn't they? Lost or something.
Albert von Lecoq was on an expedition out there, and he had to meet up with a colleague of his. And he wasn't sure whether he'd have time to get to this Dunhuang and the Caves of the Thousand Buddhas and still hook up with his colleague. And so he had no choice. What he did, he decided, well, I'll flip a coin. And on the flip of a coin, he lost and went back to find his...
To meet his boss.
Who was then, you know, months late.
Yes, that's
so he could have gone there and got to the Caves of the Thousand Buddhas first.
Joyce Morgan and Conrad Walters are here. They've told the story of the discovery of the Diamond Sutra, this incredibly invaluable book, the world's oldest printed book in a cave on the Silk Road 100 years ago. So once he found his way to the Cave of the Thousand Buddhas, Oralstein, after trekking for months and months and months across
He'd been on the road for about a year by the time he got to Dunhuang. He always wanted to go there because he'd heard from a Hungarian friend of his that these painted caves existed. This friend was one of the first Europeans to ever go there.
So once he got there and he met the monk, Abbot Wang, how did they get on?
Well, it was a tricky negotiation. Stein was relying on his Chinese interpreter, you know, to kind of smooth the path. And he knew that Abbot Wang really had held the key to all of this. And so he was going to have to convince him to, first of all, open the cave, and which Wang didn't at first want to do.
He's a little distrustful of showing these valuable things to a foreigner.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
So how did he persuade him to let him into the secret library?
Well, that patron saint that we were talking about earlier...
The Chinese pilgrim.
That's right. That also proved to be the patron saint of Abbot Wang, who had commissioned paintings of this patron. And Stein and Abbot Wang were talking outside it at one stage, and the painting depicted the pilgrim crossing
the mountains
on this giant white elephant. And Stein makes the point, well, you know, that's not unlike something that I'm doing now. I'm coming across the mountains from India and trying to bring back knowledge.
How convenient.
How convenient. It's not unlike what I'm doing. I like that. So he was then given admittance into the secret library. How did he persuade the abbot to let him walk away with the Diamond Sutra?
Look, it was inch by inch. First he persuaded him to let him see in the cave. Then the next step was, okay, now let me take some scrolls to have a look what they are. And initially he didn't want to, particularly Chinese scrolls. The abbot was very nervous about. But eventually he let him take a few to a sort of cave next door, if you like, so he could look at them. Then the next thing was Oralstein wanted to get the scrolls back to his campsite and study them a bit longer.
All in secret. Nobody else aside from the abbot and Stein and his assistant were to know. So all this was done at night.
Yeah, so each night Stein's Chinese assistant would creep along to his tent with like armfuls of scrolls that they would look through and sort of squirrel away. And, you know, in the back of his mind was he wanted to take these scrolls away. But it was very delicate. It was like a chess game trying to negotiate, you know, and he knew at some point he was going to have to, you know, raise taking them away and buying them.
But he didn't want to be tacky about it. I'll make a donation to help you restore your beloved caves.
Yeah. And that was eventually how he convinced him. But not before at one stage Abbot Wang got cold feet about the whole thing. And Stein went along to the library cave one day and discovered that the abbot had locked it up again, and all the scrolls were back in the cave. So, you know, he must have been, I think, quite fearful that the negotiation was going to end at that stage, you know, because it was suddenly like snatched away from him. So pretty quickly they then kind of made an agreement and took away this.
Part of what helped seal that that relationship that allowed them to create the agreement was some of those scrolls that had come back, you know, in the nights, they discovered had been translated, not copied, but translated by that shared
pilgrim,
that patron saint. And so this cemented the you know, friendship that allowed them to forge this negotiation.
Yeah, because, you know, Stein then did was plant this little seed with Abbot Wang, going, gosh, look, these scrolls were translated by our mutual patron saint. You know, it's sort of divinely ordained, more or less, that I should take these away.
Again, so, conveniently.
Yeah, very conveniently.
So at last he is in possession of the Diamond Sutra, and over the deserts and mountains, bit by bit by bit, he brings it back and where it was taken to the British Library. Now, you've seen the Diamond Sutra, haven't you, Conrad? What does it look like?
We saw it in the conservator's laboratory at the British Library. And we weren't certain that we were going to get to see it. You know, we've spent all this time researching it. We're quite eager to. But we got some time with the chief conservator. And he walks over to a sort of bench. And there's this maroon box on there. And it's about the size of a sort of family-sized pizza box. And he lifts the lid. And what we saw inside was the last thing that he was conserving, which was the illustrated frontispiece of the Diamond Sutra. Which,
this is this beautiful illustration right at the front of the book. Yes.
Which, by virtue of being in the oldest printed book, is the oldest illustration in a printed book. And it features the Buddha.
The Buddha's sitting like on his lotus throne, and he's sort of in the process of delivering the Diamond Sutra. So it's almost like, you know, an action shot, if you like. And so he's surrounded by his disciples and little, they're little fearsome demons, but they actually look kind of like cute little cuddly
Ewoks or something
like that. Ewoks, exactly. And he's surrounded by, you know, heavenly beings. It's quite a lovely illustration, and it's the most famous part, you know, of the scripture itself. And so we were just so knocked out to have seen that, because the Diamond Sutra, it's not on permanent display. You know, you can't put paper on display forever. It's been on display sort of just for short times. So we were absolutely thrilled to see it.
It was in the British Library all that time. What happened during the Second World War?
It went off on another incredible adventure. During the war, of course, London was heavily bombed and the museums were emptied out of all the great treasures. What we discovered was that the Diamond Sutra and the other scrolls that Stein had brought back ended up at a place called Aberystwyth. Now, that's a little seaside town on the Mid Welsh coast. And the reason it went there was, first of all, it went to the National Library of Wales, which is on a hill above Aberystwyth.
This big, imposing, grey building, you know, that just sits above the entire town and sort of stares down at it imperiously.
That's right. And it was there for some, you know, in the early part of the war. But as the war progressed, there was fear that no building above ground was going to be safe for all these treasures. And there was lots of other treasures that went to Wales as well.
I mean, in a way, because it was so imposing, it almost, you know, had a target mark on it. I know what it is.
Yeah. So what happened was that about 200 metres just below the library on this big hillside, they started digging a tunnel into the slate, the Welsh slate. And it's a horseshoe-shaped tunnel. And they built it to put inside all these great literary treasures from, you know, I think the Magna Carta.
Magna Carta's there. Some of Shakespeare's folios were there.
They all went
in. The Magna Carta, Shakespeare's folios, and the Diamond Sutra went into a couple of drawers in a tunnel in Wales.
That's what appears to have happened. And I think what we really liked about this rather delicious irony that, you know, within, after being for 1,000 years, you know, in a handmade cave in the Gobi Desert, within 50 years, it's in a handmade cave in the Welsh hillside. So
it's kind of, in a way, I suppose it's a good thing it spent all that time in Britain, because if it may well have been destroyed in the Cultural Revolution if it had stayed in China. But the Cultural Revolution is long gone. Do the Chinese want it back?
They haven't asked for it back, that we're aware of. I mean, Stein is, you know, not a popular figure in China, it has to be said.
Well, he's seen as a pillaging foreign devil.
Well, probably the worst of the foreign devils that ever came along the Silk Road, yes.
He took, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 scrolls away single-handedly.
Yeah, I suppose you could make the argument, though. I don't know if the Chinese would like it very much. He took the Diamond Sutra out of China and saved it from a century of Chinese chaos, which is what China went through pretty much after that period.
Yeah, look, it's very hard kind of judging today, by, you know, judging him now by the different standards. But
it may well be time for it to go back, though, mightn't it?
It could well be. But one of the things that the British Library has done is make it available online in ways that it couldn't possibly be available otherwise. There's at least 4 different ways I can think of that you can view this thing online. And in some points, you know, you can see the wrinkles on Subhuti's neck on that illustration, and you can see individual mulberry fibers that, you know, comprise the paper that it was printed on.
Yes. So today, you know, it is available, you can see it, you know, online, because as I said, you can't put it on display. So whether it was in Beijing or in London, you wouldn't
It has its own virtual life.
Yeah, that's right.
Once it was brought back to, you know, to Britain and then given to the world, the origins of Buddhism were then much better understood in the West. What influence did it have now that the Diamond Sutra was brought out into the world and could be published and anyone could read it?
Well, the Diamond Sutra has been quite influential on a number of kind of artists, and one of the main ones is Jack Kerouac, the great beat writer. And he got into Buddhism as quite a young man, I think in his 20s. And particularly after he'd written On the Road, you know, his seminal work, he decided to go up on this mountain on the Canadian border for a summer as a fire lookout. And he couldn't take very much with him. But the one thing he took was a copy of the Diamond Sutra. And he used
stolen from his local library.
Did he return it?
He did. No.
He never returned it.
No, he's got.
Imagine the overdue fine.
I know. Imagine that.
So he took it up there, and he would sit and study it each day. And he even attempted his own kind of rendition of the Diamond Sutra. So it had a big impact on him over the years. And
And the Dalai Lama too. Now, you went and interviewed the Dalai Lama, Joyce. What did his English isn't perfect, nonetheless, you interviewed him. What did he have to tell you about the Diamond Sutra and what it means to him?
Yeah, he said to me that the Diamond Sutra, he said, you know, it's. I asked him what its importance was. And he said its importance is, you know, it's about everything changing, that what we think is fixed isn't. And if we don't understand that, you know, that's why we all suffer, because we think everything's fixed. And he said to me, although he doesn't study the Diamond Sutra every day, it's not part of his daily practice, but he said the moment he wakes up in the morning, he thinks about its meaning and about impermanence.
He told you, I don't know who you are, didn't he?
That's right.
He said, not as a kind of rude way, but in the Buddhist sense of the word. Tell me what he meant by that.
I think what he meant is there's no kind of fixed person. Yes, you know, on a mundane level, you exist. Richard Feidler exists. Conrad Walters exists. But on a sort of a greater level, everything is, things are, you know, are moving. So even though, like, you know, when you get to 70, and it's a long time before you will be, Richard, but are you the same person or not? You know, what is it that stays the same? What is it that changes? And I think his what he was saying to me is that everything does change.
Nothing is fixed and independent. Yeah. And things. Mm. Yeah, the way he describes it reminds me of quantum physics in a lot of ways. It's like, you know, everything exists within a probability cloud of some kind.
There's lot of similarities with quantum physics. From the little I know of quantum physics.
Yeah, indeed, the little I know too. I should say that as well. So it's had this it's had this kind of subtle impact then as it's sort of seeped out into the West through writers there and back into, you know, Tibet and northern India and the world at large through the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, well, I think what, you know, what's kind of interesting is that, in a sense, Buddhism has almost come full circle now. It's, you know, it began in India, travelled along the Silk Road into China, and now has in a sense come back to India largely because of the number of Tibetan refugees who fled and have based themselves now in northern India. So it's like, you know, the wheels turn full circle.
There are places in New York where they recite the whole of the Diamond Sutra every day, aren't there, Conrad?
Yes, I spoke to a fellow who, they get up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, they go down into the basement of this suburban house and they'll recite it, you know, 3-4 times, and then go out into their daily lives. The fellow I spoke to is a lawyer, and he just says, look, it reminds me of the importance of life and being mindful about the things around me.
Has it affected you, both of you, and your marriage? I mean, in the sense, we all lead busy lives, and it's often hard to take time to sort of contemplate these things and the paradoxes that are inherent within them. Mm. Has it changed you and how you get on with each other?
I think it makes me think a little bit more about, you know, that things do change. So I think, you know, if anything, I'm more relaxed when things don't work out how you might expect, because I just kind of think, well, nothing's the same. You know, nothing's fixed forever.
And I think it helped us put ego aside when we were, you know, working on the book.
Right. So
we tried.
When you have the Diamond Sutra of the knowledge of that, you can collaborate successfully as a married couple and write a book. And indeed, when you get a bag of chickens on your lap, you go, well, this too will pass. What is a chicken? What is a bag? What is me? Am I on a bus? Yes, this kind
Absolutely.
Of thing. Absolutely. Helps you get through those extraordinary moments. Dude, it's a lovely story, and it's taken you all over the world and through some of the most strange and remote parts to actually find out this story. It's really quite an amazing thing to have done this, Joyce.
Look, I think for me, it's been one of the greatest joys is to, you know, if I could say the places I would love to visit or work in, there would be things like the British Library, the Bodleian Library. I'd love to go to the Gobi Desert and the Taklamakan Desert. And I couldn't think of, for me, a better project that has allowed us to do those together.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. Great to have you in today and lovely to meet you both. And thank you so much for being my guests in conversation.
Great
thank you
pleasure.
So much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.